Good morning, world. Good morning, world. Good morning, world, to everyone except Turkey's president, Erdogan, Azerbaijan's president, Aliyev, anybody in power in either of those countries. I hope you wake up with dysentery, or at the very least, eat an omelet this morning with runny eggs and have the shits. Because you suck. To the rest of the world, truly beautiful morning here in PSAC. I hope it's beautiful where you are. I'm looking out from my badass recording studio here across the valley at the PSAC, the Urubamba Mountains, here in the PSAC ruins. Sun is shining. A lot of blue sky. Birds are chirping. Just a beautiful morning here. Got my coffee. 4 shots of espresso straight to the face. So, only a couple down. That's what I'll be sipping on. We were treated to a really nice thunderstorm last night. Bright. Whoop-a! Cracks. They were close. It was like it was happening right here in our little valley. And yeah, it was a nice thunderstorm. Just hear it rolling through the valley. But yeah, so beautiful morning, you know. Nice little shot of rain last night too. And kind of paradise here. In contrast to where we're going in today's episode, much, much nicer. So, that being said, let's get into it. November 18th, 2020 was the most, I hope bizarre is the right way to put it, day of my life. November 18th, 2020. I have a video that I'm going to play for you guys towards the end of the episode. I'll post it on Instagram as well, and I'll post it on Facebook. I've watched the video a number of times in the course of the last year, and every single time I watch it, I'm fascinated by just like looking at myself and wondering like what the hell is going through this kid's mind this night where he is. The video is just a lonely traveler eating a lonely traveler's hotel room dinner, 2 bowls of ramen noodles, and a bottle of wine. But there's so much more behind the video. And before I play the video, let me tell you about my day in the Lachin Corridor on November 18th, 2020. The day began in Goris, a mountain town in southern Armenia, near the border of Artsakh at the edge of the Lachin Corridor, a mountain pass road connecting Armenia to Artsakh's capital city, Stepanakert. Last night's bottle of wine knocked me out cold, but lingered in my blood until morning. I woke only half-rested and with a foggy mind. The owner of the hostel informed me the night before that breakfast would be prepared for me when I was ready. Groggy and froggy and ready to eat, I made my way downstairs for breakfast. She treated me to a king's breakfast. 2 plates of cheese. Armenian cheese is very salty, by the way. Salami, sausage, delicious though. Biscuits, crackers, 2 flavors of jam, a bowl of bread, and a carton of orange juice. And of course, a cup of muddy Armenian coffee. While I ate, the surrounding mountains slept soundlessly, tucked in cozy under a heavy, dreary gray blanket of fog. After breakfast, I saw no reason to disturb the quiet mountains just yet, so I tucked myself back into bed under my own heavy blanket and drifted quietly back to sleep, tummy full of cheese. The mountains must have been cozy under the heavy gray blanket because 10 a.m. rolled around and still not a stir. I hopped into my rental Kia with a decision to make. Continue south to Kapan, where the bulk of Russian peacekeeping force was still stationed. They thundered down to Armenia and Artsakh in massive convoys only a week earlier, and still long lines of armored trucks could be seen in transit, moving along at an excruciatingly slow pace on their way to keep the peace after the treaty was signed on November 10th to end the 44-day war between Azerbaijan, Turkey, and Armenia over lands in the region of Nagorno-Karabakh, also known as Artsakh. The other option was to steer east and try my hand at smuggling through the 5 Russian-held checkpoints along the Lachin Corridor in plain sight, playing the role of a dumb, lost American with a microphone on display in his passenger seat, signaling, obvious press member, see my microphone? Who needs a press pass when the proof is in the pudding and the pudding is right there to be seen in the driver's seat? I have a microphone, for crying out loud. I am the press. Kia Jesus took the wheel and I found myself chugging up and over the mountain east of Goris, heading for Artsakh. That morning in the fog-covered mountains, 6,300 miles away from home, with no self-service and no map, felt like driving straight into the barrel of a smoking gun. Murder. These sacred mountains, where 7,000 humans lost their lives in a 44-day war, fighting for their right to stake their claim on the land. And how silly it all seems to an outsider to think that these ancient, sleepy mountains still tucked in, undisturbed by the continual roaring of Russian tanks and Praga V3S transport trucks up and down the corridor, care little who plants a flag in her dirt. I think if we asked the mountains for an opinion on the matter, the reply would go something like this. I'm tired of absorbing the impact of your artillery and the bombs dropped from your drones. I'm tired of absorbing the burning white phosphorus munitions you rain down from the sky. I'm tired of absorbing the blood of your brothers. For what? But this, of course, is not Wonderland. This is real life. The Kia bawled forward through the fog on a narrow and shoulderless 2-lane highway, visibility of perhaps 20 yards. Eventually, I rose above the clouds and the mountains finally revealed themselves. They appeared to me as a grumpy grandfather, ancient, round, and bald. The energy was reminiscent of my childhood days sitting in my grandparents' basement listening to my grandpa on the phone with customer service agents. Grumpy. 40 minutes east of Goris, the highway descends, firmly planting me inside the Karabakh Range along the Lachin Corridor. Distracted by the mountains and the time-lapse video I was recording on my phone, I soon found myself fishtailing on a slick and soggy road. The rental careened around a hairpin turn and out of the mist appeared a blockaded road manned by a group of Russian soldiers. Two of the soldiers motioned their arms for me to slow down. I'm about to get my answer to the question. Will a microphone and recorder on display in my passenger seat be enough to validate my credentials as an official member of the press? Perhaps not more than 40 yards in front of the barricade, I noticed a slight right off-ramp of sorts. Out of instinct, I yanked the wheel to the right, smooth as a professional transporter, and slid down a dirt road through a brush-covered grazing area which ran alongside a river. Immediately to my left, I spotted a handful of troops hunkered down around a burning barrel underneath a gillied-out tent, built as an extension off one of those monstrous Praga V3S transport vehicles. Further down the road, an elderly woman collected thin branches of wood from freshly chopped brush. A small herd of cows were seen grazing in the small clearing to my left. A military jeep approached me on the road and passed by. Immediately, my eyes shot to the rearview mirror. No ruby-red brake lights. They are not interested. Whew. The road took a 90 left and a 2-track bridge dared me to a crossing. Similar to pulling a car into a car wash, only here a silver-blue river roared over a rocky riverbed 4 feet below. Slow and steady, but also focus on your video. Clank! My front tires dropped off the bridge back onto the eroded dirt road. Whoa! That couldn't have been good, I proclaimed to myself. And all of a sudden, I'm driving through a neighborhood. One leafless, lonely oak tree sitting at the end of a row of houses reaches into the sky, silhouetted against the gray background. The people living along this dirt road, just inside the Karabakh Mountains, are lucky. Luck is relative, right? These people are lucky. They won't be forced out of their homes in the coming weeks. Though a force of Russian soldiers occupy the town and man the roads in and out, believe it or not, their lives are going on as normal compared with their neighbors just another 60 miles east of Shushi, or even deeper into Free Artsakh in the Kalbakar region. I'm probably saying that incorrectly, but want to be clear that I'm using the Armenian spelling of the word Kalbakar. But let's not foil the fun so soon. We'll pay a visit to the people of Kalbakar tomorrow. For now, we are back in the Kubaks village in the Lachin district. A yellow sprinter van full of soldiers bears down on me from the road and gives a honk. This morning, all alone on this gloomy road, a spike in heart rate is proportional to the jolt of an unexpected car horn. What the fuck? I notice the driver and the passenger staring at me through the windshield. Eyes to the rear view once again. This time the brake lights light up. Oh, shit. Whew! They were only slowing down for the bridge. Another one eluded. Soon the dirt road climbed out of the village and came to a T with the highway. I turned right back onto the highway, and voila! I have done it. I have inadvertently dodged the checkpoint and appeared back on the highway above the checkpoint without any resistance at all. All the stress and worry in the weeks leading up to my journey to Armenia about getting a press pass, one I was not ultimately granted, one that was not ultimately necessary. Suck it! Six monstrous trucks, each packed full of Russian peacekeepers, streamed by me on the road. A Russian peacekeeping vehicle can easily be recognized by a blue dot with square yellow letters MP on the side of any given vehicle. Their presence is a grubby feeling. You know that feeling? That grubby feeling? It just feels dirty. That feeling of, how long are you going to be here, Mr. Russian MP, military police? How long are you going to be in this foreign country, which you used to occupy so that you can police it? You know, that grubby feeling. What are your motives and what are your incentives, you grubby MP? Anyway, some police force you are allowing a weaselly wannabe member of the press and a little Kia through your big bad checkpoint. Gotcha! Again, the fog cleared enough that the mountains revealed themselves to me once again. I can't shake this grumpy grandfather energy. The mountains are dry and rocky, and millions of years of erosion have rounded their edge. Armenians are thought to have inhabited the region of Artsakh for, get this, 9,000 years, since 7,000 BC. I'll give you some perspective on that number while we wind our way down into another valley of the ancient Artsakh range. 7,000 BC. Let's take a look at that date. The ancient Egyptians built the pyramids of Giza between the ages of 2550 to 2490 BC. Jesus was alive in the years somewhere between 6 BC and 36 AD. That means we, in the modern day, are closer on the calendar to Jesus than Jesus was to the Egyptians. And in 2020, the year that Turkey paid its little henchman country Azerbaijan to attack Artsakh on its behalf, we are closer to the Egyptians on the calendar than the Egyptians are to the first Armenian people to inhabit Artsakh. What claim to this land could Azerbaijan possibly have to this land, then? Azerbaijan was not even a nation until 1918. Azerbaijani is not a religion, nor is it an ethnicity. The people of Azerbaijan are Muslims who happen to live in a Soviet-constructed nation without a true home. Just south of the village of Arar, totally guessing there, the road diverges just before crossing a river. A freshly built berm skirts around the riverbend, and to my right I see the reason why. A bridge has been struck by an artillery round. Perhaps even it was the target of a drone strike. Drone strike. Those two words alone are enough to make the hairs of anyone in the region stand on end. Drones were the story of the 44-day war, to be discussed in another episode. A wave of Soviet-era tanks thunder by me on the road in a mash and grind of steel and asphalt, and I was shaken from my thoughts. Damn it! I missed them! Ahead, I saw another wave of tanks rounding out a corner ahead of me on the mountain road. I quickly whipped out my camera to capture the next pass of patrolling tanks. I was giddy with the excitement of a 5-year-old to see real-life tanks on patrol. I could not believe what I was seeing, but I knew it was exciting. Now I wonder if it really was exciting, or if it only felt exciting because I was running high on adrenaline to get me through the overly stimulating environment I was steering my consciousness through. Unconsciously, my body was mass-producing the necessary adrenaline, and probably wondering how the hell it ended up thousands of miles away from home in these creepy, foggy mountains, crawling with soldiers from 3 separate armies, bloodied and dimpled from 44 days of recent bombardment and bloodshed. Alone in a little black rental Kia, in a land where, as I would later find out, both soldiers and civilians were actively being kidnapped even after the peace treaty. The beauty of well-timed ignorance, I guess. All in all, I was passed by nearly 20 tanks on the road that day. The tanks were not the only military personnel patrolling the grumpy mountains. It's no surprise they appear grumpy. I could hear them screaming, "Quiet down now, you hear?" after each convoy of tanks roared by. I passed by a group of soldiers standing next to a transport vehicle and couldn't help but be bothered by all the constant staring. Staring makes me feel as if I'm doing something wrong. Why would all these soldiers be so interested in a white guy in a bright lime green coat and a Kia driving through their little village in the mountains? Is it a cultural behavior? Am I suspicious looking? I don't understand. I just hope the staring eyes are Russian or Armenian only. Outside the peering eyes of Russians and Armenians, I have no interest in catching the gaze of any other interested parties. I notice the power lines up to this point are still standing and in working condition. On my right, a Soviet-era anti-missile battery parked at the mountain edge aims to the gray heavens, on guard. And then another. All along the mountain pass, soldiers are hunkered down, nestled tightly into the hillside. I wonder how long each of the soldiers must be deployed and how active they remain on any given day. A long way from nowhere. Where do they sleep? What do they do all day? Just standing at their outpost, in the elements, must drive one insane. Do they stay on this mountainside for a year? Do they rotate? Did they bring an Xbox? Do they eat canned Russian military rations day after day? Gross. I look at the sky again and imagine overcast gray skies were a welcome relief for the Armenian soldiers defending the front lines during the war. Hard to operate a drone on such a heavily clouded day. Another missile battery. This one surrounded by a few men in a 4-foot-high stack of white sandbags. Ahead on the road, a blue sign appears. Sushi, 30 kilometers. Stepanakert, 40 kilometers. Just past the road sign and a slight right around the bend, 3 tanks sit parked, ready for action. Ahead of me now, clogging the road, is a gray lineman truck with a red hydraulic bucket lift. I spend a few minutes lagging behind before finally seizing an opportunity to whiz by the big truck and continue along the curvy, foggy mountain pass. Suddenly, a wall of sandbags stretches halfway across the narrow road, and ahead, another wall of sandbags reaches out from the opposite side of the road, and once more from each side. Past the zigzagging obstacle course, at a corner sits a building being guarded by 2 Russian armored personnel vehicles. Around the corner, more walls of sandbags present a weaving challenge, presumably to slow drivers to a desirable speed. I wonder what makes this particular curve important enough to require obstacles on the highway. The image reminds me of a real-life version of the computer game I used to play, Command & Conquer, Red Alert. A white van makes its way through the obstacle course in the opposite direction. I'm stuck behind the first wall, forced to wait for the van to exit. Not a favorable placement, I think. And to my dismay, the white van pulls up next to me and the window rolls down. The man utters something incomprehensible, and I reply back, English? A short pause, and the man in a heavy accent seems to struggle in asking, Is the panicket? Uh-huh. More alien language. Then, sushi? Stepanakert? Mm-hmm. Motioning now, I realize he is asking that I take his passenger on to Stepanakert. I wondered why he needed a ride back down the only possible road the exact way he just came from, but agreed to take him anyway. Hurriedly, I packed away my podcasting equipment and cleared the passenger seat for my new companion, who I hope is not going to carjack or kidnap me. Okay, I say. The stranger, dressed in black from his shoes to his stocking cap, opens the right passenger door, tosses in his black duffel bag, and hops in the front seat. All aboard. 10 minutes up the road, higher into the mountains, the most intense fog of the day swallows us in the mountain's hole. The road is no longer paved, but rather sheared off to a gravel surfacing. Perhaps this section took a beating from artillery during the war. Three tanks emerge from the thick fog and slink slowly along the dank road. The driver's lone helmeted head just peaks high enough from the hatch to see the road, and a machine gunner in regular winter garb sits atop, probably wondering, what the fuck am I doing here? I need vodka. A white and black spotted dog stands in the middle of the road watching the tanks rumble by. Two Russian soldiers dressed in heavy winter gear and large radio helmets stand at the edge of the road, each with an AK slung over his shoulder. Ghostly figures against the dense gray backdrop. At last, the final tank rolls by and we are moving forward again. Just up the road, my midnight rider and I find ourselves in a traffic jam with Russian military personnel. Another tank rolls by. On our right are two large satellite communication systems. Ahead of us, a gaggle of transport vehicles jockey for position around the curve. I pulled over to allow the passing of an armored personnel carrier. One soldier's head was visible out of a front porthole. His headgear resembled a 1920s American football helmet. I suppose it keeps his ears warm in this cold mountain air. We inch forward but have to pull over for an approaching V3S monster truck. Any one of these vehicles would squash the little Kia like a bug. We cleared the traffic jam and inched ever closer to Stepanakert. I'm still weary of my rider in black and keep my eyes on his hands at all times, darting from road to hands to road to hands. Soon we pass a couple of fuel tanker trucks and a group of soldiers parked on the road next to a dug-in tank that kept a watchful eye on the gray mountain abyss. Then out of nowhere, the skies exploded into an inviting and cheerful mess of bright white clouds and blue skies. Still, the skies are mostly covered in clouds, but there's enough blue sky peeking through to light up the world around us. Figure now would be a great time to queue up a fire playlist for my guy. Bring me a higher love. Whoa. A little Whitney. Taste of Rhymesayer's finest, Atmosphere, and some One Direction to feel him out. Allowing the dark night to tag along turned out to be the best decision I made all day. As it turned out, the checkpoint I dodged in Kubuks would not be the only checkpoint to contend with that day. We would pass through three more checkpoints before reaching Shushi. At every checkpoint, I pulled over the car, handed my passport to the Russian soldier, kept my mouth shut, and let the guardian angel over my right shoulder do the talking. What story is he telling the Russians? What does he say about me? What does he say about us? I wonder if he himself was a soldier during the war. Any male civilian under the age of 58 was on call to report for duty. No matter what he told the guards, it didn't matter to me, because at each checkpoint we were allowed to pass. Almost symbolically, the clouds darkened again, and in the distance, shrouded beneath a veil of cloud cover, appeared the impressive rock fortress city of Shushi. Sushi was a key battle, perhaps the key battle during the war, and strategically the most important Armenian-held outpost. Ultimately, it was lost to the Azerbaijani forces, if that's what you prefer to call the opposing army. More accurately described as Azerbaijani soldiers, paid Syrian mercenaries, and Turkish military personnel. The fall of Sushi marked the beginning of the end of the war. We pulled over to pause and take a picture of the imposing fortress city, now in control of enemy forces. My rider in black also hopped out of the car. We peered across the valley together, and though we were looking at the same scene, we must have processed two completely separate views, two different stories, two completely distinct set of feelings. I can't imagine what he felt that day, looking out across the valley to Azerbaijani-controlled Sushi. Those words, if I could communicate to him, would probably pierce through his heart. I offered him my condolences in the form of a tray of double-stuffed Oreos. He took a few and we hopped back in the car, leaving Sushi behind. Next stop, Stepanakert. But not so fast. One final checkpoint. This checkpoint was tense. I felt an air of nervous tension heavy as the day's clouds cover hanging over the final checkpoint. Three Russians approached the vehicle and spoke with my wayfaring stranger. They ran us through the typical routine. Show me your back seat, open your bags, pop your trunk. But it all felt stressful. They asked me to pop my hood. I was nervous. This was the final checkpoint. I noticed my tray of Oreos sitting in the back seat. Thinking on my feet, I snatched them up and offered the soldiers each some Oreos. The reception was a cold, unimpressed glare from the group. Idiot! Is this a game to you? Why would you think these very serious Russian checkpoint soldiers would want your stupid double-stuffed cookie? Well, because they're double-stuffed, that's why. The main purpose of the checkpoints that day was to search for weapons moving back and forth after the war. We were not carrying any. Only double-stuffed Oreos. At long last, we were waved through. Felt like an hour. Was probably 3 minutes. I pulled slowly through the gate underneath the Russian flag. On the other side were many Westerners, mostly journalists, perhaps some humanitarians. I noticed a goofball Italian man talking animatedly into his phone, which he lifted above his head with a selfie stick. I recognized this guy from an Instagram live story I had seen a few days earlier. Inside, I laughed. Outside, I let out a deep sigh of relief. We made it. Thank you, mystery man. 100 yards up the road, the biggest tank of the day sat buried under a ghillie cover, surrounded by armed soldiers. Act natural, Dusty. Between Sushi and Stepanakert, the conditions worsened. The road was dotted with potholes and craters. Power lines lay messily across the road. At one point, we drove past a rocket that seemed to perfectly pierce the pavement, unexploded. I drove by slowly and badly wanted to pull over for a picture. Despite proving his worth, I was still on edge about my passenger. Keeping guard, anyway. I drove by without capturing the bizarre scene. 10 miles up the road from our final checkpoint, the capital city welcomed us. Eerie, empty, and quiet. My friend navigated us through the city to the Armenia Hotel. We took a selfie together, he took his duffel bag, and like an apparition, the angel of Lachin disappeared into the woeful gray shroud of fog that buried the city of Stepanakert, an uncanny reflection of the mood of the people who were still around. My first order of business, once parked at the hotel, was to pack a light backpack of essentials. Microphone and recorder, always on me just in case. Cell phone, not for navigation, but for documentation. Water and some money. I left the Kia parked at Hotel Armenia and set off into the unknown. The fog swallowed my rental car before I cleared the parking lot. Given the complete outline of the circumstances of the day, I was hesitant from the start to leave my car behind. A tense, still scalding hot civilian city, only a week removed from war, with the enemy holding several very nearby positions, a rare English speaker to be found, visibility ranging to the tip of my nose, no cell service in a foreign land far from home. I'm new to this, okay? I did not wander long before turning around. Not an easy retracing of the steps, by the way. Back at Hotel Armenia and behind the wheel, I'm feeling much less vulnerable all around, and I continue the hunt. During the war, Stepanakert was subjected to substantial amounts of artillery shelling, despite having zero military presence at all. This is, of course, against the supposed laws of war, which stand to do little but appear optically satisfying, just as much of the world operates day to day. The goal is to find at least one area of the city that took a lot of damage. With no knowledge of the geographical layout of the city, basically no sense of direction, and no cell phone service, I crept around the city looking for the carnage. The so-called illegal war crime that no one will be held accountable for. The illegal war crime of pernicious destruction shelled out on the civilian population. Energetically, the city was a mirror image of the surrounding gray space. Dismal. Just 30 minutes after leaving Hotel Armenia behind for a tour on foot before returning to my car, a 5-story yellow-gray building stretching nearly an entire block appeared out of the haze on my right. A hotel or apartment building. Nearly every window in the street-facing wall was blown out. I slowed to a roll for a few pictures, and on the far end of the building, an opening to the back of the building presented itself. I parked my car in front of the building and hopped out. Waiting around the corner was a scene of destruction. A two-story brick-light building sat with the roof and much of the second level completely wiped out. On the right was the big building I pulled over to investigate. Two massive slabs of concrete had fallen clean out of the wall. A row of brick garage stalls lay in ruin as piles of rubble. In one stall, sitting on top of the rubble, were a shiny black-blue bicycle with training wheels and a lime-green stroller, seemingly undisturbed by the surrounding chaos. In the neighboring stall, a passenger van sat mangled and crisp, as if it had taken a direct hit from the illegal enemy artillery. A pile of broken glass and debris crunched underfoot. Along the alley were mangled doors, broken windows, and dangling wires. From somewhere in the building rang the sound of a hammer. An opening in the back wall where two metal doors used to hang offered an opportunity to go inside for a closer inspection. Clearly, the owners of the building have already spent a lot of time cleaning up in the aftermath. Neat piles of debris were swept up on each landing. The fourth landing was a mess of wood lath, shattered windows, dangling crisscrossing wires, and rubble. A crumpled red door leaned against the wall, blown down from the floor above as evidenced by two red doors still in place next to a gaping hole in the wall leading to a third apartment. The top of the fifth staircase was as high as I climbed. The building is obviously under cleanup, and certain barricades have been put up in place to deter would-be thieves or looters. Someone was upstairs hammering away, and I had no interest in being misidentified as a looter, so I retreated down the steps. On the second floor, the door to one apartment was cracked wide enough for me to stick my iPhone through for a video. The room appeared exactly how I would imagine a room to appear if a frag grenade were tossed inside and the door closed behind it. If I didn't know any better, I might look at the room and assume someone is renovating the apartment full gut. Of course, we know that's not the truth. The civilian building was targeted by artillery. I exited the broken-down structure, returning to the gloom of the day, and cruised slowly through the quiet city streets for another hour and a half, searching for neighborhoods that had been hit the hardest. The buildings revealed themselves to me one at a time as I approached and then passed by, like creeping through a sleepy neighborhood in the night, headlights revealing one house at a time. After nearly 2 hours of mostly fruitless searching, I decided to return to Hotel Armenia and set out on foot once again. On my way out 2 hours earlier, I noticed at the end of the hotel parking lot was a sort of roundabout area with a number of buses and people standing around waiting to board. All of these people were evacuating. They were being forced to leave their homes and lives behind, if not directly by a boot in the ass or artillery shell through their roof, then indirectly for a number of reasons. Doesn't really matter what the reason is, though, does it? Because at the end of the day, these people are leaving home due to greed and genocidal inclinations of a more powerful nation. And that matters. In one scene, around 20 people gathered in the foreground of a white-gray canvas sky. Each and every one of them stood with both hands planted firmly in their pockets. Collective uncertainty. Some had nothing. Some had all they could stuff into a few plastic burlap bags or cardboard boxes. One man had a small white cardboard box with the word Ararat on the side. No one smiled. Across the street, a large yellow Soviet-era school bus shaped like a Twinkie sat parked in sloppy fashion, as if the driver had priorities other than a perfect parking job. A woman with two walking canes sat next to the bus, bundled up on top of one of her luggage bags. On her right was a taped-up, small cardboard box, and to her left sat a purse and a plastic shopping bag branded with large black letters announcing Ararat. Mount Ararat, Armenian's most sacred mountain, which can be seen from the capital city of Yerevan and sits across the border in, get this, modern-day Turkey. Stolen a century ago, much like these mountains were stolen during the 44-day war of 2020, a soldier carried a large yellow plastic bag in each hand to be loaded onto the bus. Behind the woman, two young children chased each other around their mother, the only rays of sunshine that would pierce the dark clouds of the day. I spent another hour walking around the nearby city blocks looking for wreckage before deciding it would be wise to return to the Armenia Hotel and secure a room for the night. I went inside and was informed they had no vacancy. No good, Dusty. No good. The hotel did have Wi-Fi, though, so I was able to connect and do some research. I was hungry and needed a room to sleep in. I compiled a list of 4 or 5 potential eateries for dinner and screenshotted maps in order to track them down. The hotel concierge advised me to check with the Park Hotel up the street. I found the Park Hotel just 1 or 2 blocks up the road, sitting directly across from the massive Serb Asfatasimor Havanu Cathedral. I was informed that the hotel had one room available, and I was going to pay for it. The Park Hotel was upscale by comparison to other accommodations in Armenia. It was a boutique hotel in a prime location. I imagine a very pleasant place to stay on a decent and sunny day. It's hard to imagine this place any other way than a sullen and gray. The hotel cost me $20, and like an absolute fool, I stuffed my pockets with the equivalent of only $50 for my journey to Artsakh. No matter how I sliced it up, it was a minimum of 2+ hours drive to proper Armenian services, such as ATMs or gas stations. Why would it ever cross my mind that I am entering a still-simmering war zone, whose infrastructure, including fiber optics, had been severely damaged? I would need gas tomorrow. I needed food now. Yikes. No extra scratch for souvenirs. Sorry, Mom. I settled into my room and gave myself a tour of the hotel before heading out in search of an ATM. Truly, it was a beautiful hotel. A windy wooden staircase spanned from the basement to the third floor. The walls were adorned with local art and beautiful tapestries, and stone archways guided me through the halls. Several small hangout areas with couches offered views of the cathedral across the street. My room was outfitted like a standard hotel room. King bed, TV, fridge, chairs and table, a couple glasses, and a full bathroom. The woodwork was beautiful, the room was spacious, and the ceilings were 10 foot high. A beautiful room indeed. At 5:45 p.m., the last hint that the sun was still up somewhere behind the gray sky started to fade, and an intense darkness settled over the quiet city. The man who gave me the room shared the location of 2 nearby ATMs, and off I went. The first ATM did not work. Okay. The second ATM was definitely not working. It showed a blank white screen with a banner displaying the full spectrum of color drooping from the right center. Shattered glass still hanging on around the frame, and the keypad covered in shards. I moved on and was feeling more comfortable navigating the city on foot in the dark for some reason. I determined my location on Apple Maps and set out for a couple of nearby restaurants I had staked out earlier. Closed, closed, and closed. I covered quite a bit of ground in my search for food and an ATM. At one point, I noticed a group of people huddled around outside a bank. People! An ATM! Yes! After waiting around long enough to find out that the Wi-Fi was down and the bank's ATMs were not working, one of the bankers, an older gentleman who spoke a bit of English, asked me where I was from, and I told him the U.S. He, like every other Armenian, true Armenian, I met in my 3 weeks exploring the land of mountains and monasteries, was absolutely elated to welcome me to his country. I can undoubtedly say that never in my life of travel have I been more openly received and welcomed than I was by the people I encountered in Armenia. He told me to come back and try the ATM in the morning and sent me off. The new plan was to return to my car and expand the food search radius. Walking back to the Park Hotel, I stumbled on a grocery store. Fine. Let me see what I can scrounge up in here. A soldier in uniform stood outside the entrance. He did not really acknowledge my presence, and a moment later, another soldier in uniform approached the door. The sentry opened the door, granting his fellow brother-in-arms access to the store. I caught a glimpse inside and noticed everyone was in full uniform. I understood and moved on. Fair play. Why should a silly American, unsure how he even ended up in this situation in the first place, think he deserves any morsel of food in such scarcity? Eventually, I found my way back to the hotel and back to my car. Aha! The Oreos. Yes! Oh, sweet double stuff. After mowing down an entire sleeve of cookies, it was time to check in with two more possible restaurants. Wouldn't you know it? Closed. Outside the final restaurant on my list, a pizza place, my path through a narrow street was obstructed by a large Red Cross truck. I sat in the middle of the street watching the driver of the truck. The driver, who I presume could have been none other than the great Austin Powers in that scene from The International Man of Mystery, attempt to back through an open metal gate, inching forward and inching backward for 5 minutes, failing to make the turn. I couldn't take it any longer, put the Kia in reverse, and made a new plan. Drive around until something reveals itself. Anything. Nearly 2 hours after leaving the hotel in search of an ATM, I finally hit the jackpot. Below the busy road I was cruising down, I saw the lights on in another grocery store. A convoluted path led me to the store, and I went inside. No one kicked me out. Score! The place had been ransacked and little remained on the shelves. Surprisingly, in this period of COVID and war, the shelves were still stocked with toilet paper. Ultimately, I settled on a hearty meal of 2 ramen noodle dishes and a bottle of Karas wine. I returned to the hotel, eager to finally feast. And something warm after a long, dismal day to boot. I had no way to heat the water for my noodles, but luckily the hotel was bustling with people. Mostly journalists, humanitarians, and a group of local Armenian men who were gathered around a TV in a smoke-filled back room watching the ongoing protests in Yerevan, calling for the resignation of Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan. A man was operating a small bar. He was also offering hot tea, so I asked him for some hot water in each of my bowl of noodles. These were fancy ramen noodles, which came with lids. I capped the noodles and returned to my hotel room and reached for my bottle of Karas wine, the subject of the video mentioned at the beginning of the story.
Alright. The thing about being in this city right now is nothing's open. Nobody's around. Because it was course of the last several weeks. So with that being said, there's nothing open. It's hard to find even a market with food on the shelves. It's pretty remarkable that there's still toilet paper. I did manage to find two boxes of ramen noodles. There's no microwave in here, so I had to go to the bar and ask for some hot tea or hot water. Also don't have a line opener, so this is how you do it. Now I pushed it almost all the way through, but not all the way through yet. Let me show you the trick that, because you don't want to spill it. And don't worry, I'm not going to drink all this wine by myself before I shower. Oh, fuck. I guess I did push it all the way through. But see now, because it floats up, so you got to kind of off-center it a little bit. You got to hope it can get down. Fuck me, I bought a white wine. Well, I thought I bought a red, which is the... I had this wine last night, and I thought I was buying the same one. I guess I didn't read carefully enough. Well, I'm just going to spill a little, because you got to get that cap down. And I got some glasses. I got it, so... Cheers. Lemonade. Gotta make do when you're in a situation like this.
I drank my wine and ate my noodles and returned to the hotel lobby and slumped over, exhausted, in a comfortable chair and tuned in to the busy scene happening around me. A man snored in the chair next to me and I closed my eyes too. English-speaking voices of varying accents dominated the space immediately surrounding me. The Armenian voices boomed passionately from the background. Though I had no idea what they were saying or what they thought about the protests happening on the streets in Armenia's capital. The English speakers were invariably in Stepanakert on behalf of a humanitarian organization, mostly Red Cross, I assumed. In the slurry of English accents, I could not identify one obviously American voice. Eventually, I dozed off, though I never truly fell asleep in that hotel lobby, like my body was unwilling to let the craziness happening around me slip away unrecorded. At 9 p.m., I had to put myself to bed, bringing to close the most bizarrely stimulating day of my life. I woke up the next morning in my bed at the Park Hotel in Stepanakert, Artsakh. The previous day was not a dream. That means the people of Artsakh hadn't dreamt it either. This is their sad reality. I had the privilege of leaving Stepanakert that morning, leaving Artsakh behind. Not leaving behind in the sense that I am leaving my home and life behind, not like the people of Artsakh will be forced to. I simply disappeared like a wayward traveler who does not have to live out the reality that the people of Artsakh will have to face in the days and years to come. A stone monument without a base sits just outside the city of Stepanakert, depicting Grandpa and Grandma. Symbolically and intentionally crafted without a base, Grandpa and Grandma represent the connection of the people of Artsakh to the mountains. Translated from Armenian, the name of the monument reads, "We are our mountains." Now the people of Artsakh have been forced from their homes and the mountains ripped from their hearts. For what?